Hey everybody, we're back. DER Task Force here. We're with Casey Handmer. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Handmer.
Yeah.
Awesome. And Casey's the founder and CEO of Terraform Industries, a really interesting company that I think we've all been seeing a lot of lately. So we're here to talk. We're here to talk utility scale DERs, as we call them. Natural gas, maybe Mars. Something we want to start with. Is Casey, how did you end up working on energy, and are you DER pilled? If you don't know
Oh,
what
very
that
much so.
means, oh, okay, you're with it. Okay,
Yeah,
cool.
no, I'm with it. I've been all about the DERs for almost 10 years. And thanks so much for having me here. It's great to talk energy nerd stuff with energy nerds. Well, I knew and I knew that solving the energy problem was the key to solving the climate crisis, probably in 2011. So I was probably only 10 or 20 years after everyone else. But it became clear to me that we might need some kind of innovative business model to really make progress there. And so I set out to figure out what that was in a very roundabout way. And a couple of years ago now, 3 years ago, basically realized that the key might be synthetic fuel, which is then what we set out to do.
And do I have, from what I remember, you're at Jet Propulsion Lab before? Is that right?
I've been super fortunate to work at a bunch of incredible places with just filled with really smart people. So I came out to the United States as a student to do my PhD at Caltech in 2010. In 2015, I finished that and went over to Hyperloop, where I got to work with kind of the first generation of SpaceX refugees, trying to do crazy stuff in the real world, and stuck it out there for 2.5 years, and then I went over to JPL for 4 whole years. It doesn't feel like 4 years, but spent 4 years of my life there, mostly working on radar-related stuff and a little bit of extraterrestrial mapping. And some machine vision and AI stuff as well, and then eventually realized that having spent essentially my entire life up to that point trying to work for NASA, it was time to leave.
Well, I don't want to go too deep down the rabbit hole on the Hyperloop front, but we were just talking to Quincy on the last episode, if from Electric Era, if you're familiar with him, about sort of like for engineers in our generation, you could like go the SpaceX or the Tesla route, basically. I mean, mechanical engineering backgrounds. And funny enough, I was doing a master's PhD in mechanical engineering at UT, and I had a physics background, and we like competed in the SpaceX Hyperloop competition. Like I like started and led a team. That was kind of my first startup in a way. We were pretty wedded to like the air, trying to make air bearings work, which didn't ultimately pan out in the Hyperloop trajectory, as we know. But I am curious, like how you and Quincy both have like an interest in space and energy, and that's very it seems to be the themes of our times. But like, how did you go from NASA to energy? Like, what was the switch in your head? Like, I don't
Well,
want to do space anymore. I want to work on energy.
I mean, a few different pieces fell into place, but you have to remember, like, the second half of my time at NASA was COVID, so we were mostly working from home, and I had initially one and then two small children, and my wife was also working remotely for NASA, and it was all kind of intense. One of the things that I did during that period was finally finish and publish a book on Mars industrialization, and of course, anyone who's spent half their life thinking about building cities on Mars will immediately recognize that you need DERs on Mars as well. And but in particular, Mars doesn't have naturally occurring hydrocarbons as far as we know, and so you would need to produce them there if you wanted to be able to make plastics, or certain kinds of fuel, or to fly a Starship home from Mars to Earth. And so, kind of did the math on that, and then realized that it's incredibly energy intensive, which is a huge challenge on Mars, but maybe less so on Earth. And in particular, cheap solar kind of gives you a handout or a hand up, a way to make that work financially on Earth. And if it doesn't work financially, of course, you can put as much effort into it as you want, but you've really only perfected a machine that consumes value. It's like a yacht or a sports car or something like that. But that's not necessarily a net economically productive thing. And it's super critical, as you all know, as business people in this space, that you deliver value to your customers. If you don't deliver value to your customers, you're going to run out of customers very quickly. So that was kind of the genesis of that. And I did a bunch of reading on kind of the legacy oil and gas industry. And then I did a bit of reading on the history of synthetic fuel and a bunch of other things, and eventually realized that that it was, I don't know, it's kind of goaded into it in a way by a friend of mine who's also an entrepreneur. But essentially the idea is like, well, there's this looming, blindingly obvious aspect of the future. No one else seems to be building it. It does need to exist. Well, I guess I better go and build it.
That has to be the, I think I just gonna give you the word for the coolest like founder trajectory story ever, saying I was gonna make synthetic natural gas on Mars and then just realize I should just do it on Earth instead. That's what it sounds like. Well,
I wouldn't rule out Mars long term either. in some ways,
step like, one Earth.
In terms of personal motivation, like in terms of my own career progression, you know, I felt like at my age, it's time for me to actually like get some bloody knuckles, like actually, maybe that's the wrong metaphor, but like actually like running teams and taking like deep and core responsibility for technical development and business development and team development and stuff like that. Cause I really wasn't getting that experience at JPL and I wanted that experience. And so, you know, the only way to get that experience is to go and do it. So it's kind of a lot of things came together. I think initially I kind of wanted to set up a laboratory and just kind of experiment and see if I could prove out some ideas. But eventually I realized that it was a project that was too big for me to do by myself. And so I needed to get other people involved. And the easiest way to do that is to align their incentives through a Delaware C Corp using the engine of capitalism, which we all know and love, which I did.
Awesome. I really want to just get a high level of Terraform. But first, something you said that I have to comment on is the history of synthetic fuels. That is very interesting to actually ponder that. There was a time in the U.S. when most of the gas we burned was quote, town gas, right? Where it was actually manufactured in a plant, probably from coal, I think, and sent around town. And like the house I grew up in had, they weren't in use anymore, but the sort of like gas lamps on the wall. And those were fed by synthetic gas one day, long, long ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I've never read in depth about that, but I think it would be remiss of me not to mention, at least there's a fabulous book called The Alchemy of Air by, I think, Thomas Heger. And it covers the kind of the development of industrial scale synthetic chemistry in Germany, mostly in the interwar period. And they got started with ammonia and fertilizer, and then they progressed to basically doing the same thing, but with carbon in the form of coal and making liquid fuels, which subsequently, you know, basically fueled the Nazi war machine. But I don't think they had that. I don't think they had that in mind when they got started, and a few other side projects in German chemical research. That technology still exists. It's still applied in some places. South Africa, in particular, still makes a lot of fuel from coal, and that, you know, that process kind of makes sense in that you need a source of energy, and coal provides that energy. But if you have super cheap solar power, then you can kind of get away with not using coal and instead use atmospheric CO2, which is what we're doing, to make your fuel. And the nice side effects of that are that you can make fuel wherever you can throw out some solar panels. So you don't have to be in Saudi Arabia to drill a hole, or Texas and drill a hole and get oil out of the ground. Essentially, anywhere where there's underutilized land, you can put some solar arrays out and then you can make fuel. You can basically turn, you know, neglected underutilized land into an oil gusher. Like, that's a pretty good pitch.
As I understood it, that's also why the Germans developed it, because they didn't have access to resources. And there's actually a great section in the prize it wasn't even, obviously it's a bit more expensive, but it was doing just fine until basically the Allies like bombed all the plants, as I understand it, and that sort of crippled their access to the resource. But it sort of show time, like, actually, you can build this crazy industrialized engine off of synthetic fuels, like, effectively.
Well, yeah, the chemical plant is still there. It's called Leuna, and it's in the part of northern Germany that was part of the Soviet Union until relatively recently, and the plant today doesn't make synthetic fuel. It makes other chemicals, but it was bombed so comprehensively that essentially you're not encouraged to disturb the soil, because you'll almost certainly discover unexploded ordnance. And of course, if they're doing construction, then they do very thorough searches for that. But you know, like, I think they dropped a 15 kiloton nuke on Hiroshima but they dropped more than 15 kilotons of TNT on Luna, trying to disrupt this production. We're kind of getting in the weeds here, but the Nazis also obtained oil from Romania and from Azerbaijan more conventionally. But those were also disrupted in a series of bombing raids. At the end of the day, if you're going to get involved in a land war, it's very unwise to invite on the opposite side the United States, who has industrial capacity that far exceeds everyone else combined, and is able to produce bombers faster than you can produce bullets, as ultimately the Nazis discovered. But I think long term, not necessarily to the detriment. Both kind of the irony of World War II is, and in particular the post-war reconstruction effort, is that both Germany and Japan, despite badly losing those wars, are much more prosperous today than they ever could have been under their pre-war kind of expansionist and old school colonialist policies. And actually Japan, for the same matter, was like expanding down into Borneo for the same reason, to secure its supply chain for oil. I think oil was always going to run out sooner or later. We have to find some post-oil solution. And part of that is electrification, right? And part of that is just pure electrification of existing uses of fossil fuels, or users of fossil fuels. But part of that is also finding a synthetic hydrocarbon supply chain that can basically provide humans the high-quality energy and fuels that they will, and also chemical precursors that they will need for the coming centuries and millennia, in essentially unlimited quantities.
I'll just round out the history session here by just saying that is in fact why we call it natural gas today, right? At one point it was all synthetic, and then we started finding it naturally, and we're like, wow, there's natural gas. It just comes, we don't have to manufacture it anymore. It just comes out of the earth the right way. So it's interesting to kind of see the circle there and it come back around.
Yeah. Now we're making unnatural gas, but, sorry.
Pauline. Yeah. So in thinking of what Terraform Industries has been doing, I'm curious, the way that I saw it described of taking historical processes and sort of packaging them in a new way, is this the sort of fracking equivalent of getting to synthetic gas, where we're taking historical processes, putting them together in an innovative way, and really making it commercially viable? Or is there a special sauce component in there of Terraform that's like game changing in the market? Like, it's game changing in the industry, but you know what I'm saying? Like, fracking was taking a few processes that existed and put together another way, and it totally changed the gas industry. But there wasn't necessarily that new process,
like breakthrough innovation
thing.
Or something.
Yeah, the breakthrough innovation. The breakthrough was the combination.
Well, I think it's probably safe to say the devil is always in the details. And
fair enough.
And an awful lot of technical innovation and investment has gone into fracking over the years.
Bring on the details.
We've interviewed a few people here who worked on, for example, high pressure pumps, which are part of the fracking system. And it's just like, if you've seen the movie Pacific Rim or something, and you've got these giant mechs or whatever they call them, like running around, and you're like, you're just trying to imagine the engineering required to build one of those. And that's the sort of engineering that goes into these high pressure fracking pumps, because they have to be able to like move enormous volumes of water and with all kinds of crap in it at extremely high pressures. And then shoot that down the hole to open up, like hydraulically fracture, and then prop these cracks open and let the gas out. And they're just like, oh, of course we're using miraging steel there. What else would we use? Like, this is literally up against the limits of chemistry for the strength of materials. In terms of what we're doing, it's kind of my job to try and reduce the risk as much as possible, because risk is expensive, right? So as much as possible, we're trying to avoid reinventing the wheel as much as possible, avoid really complex and expensive technologies. That said, every time an engineer puts pen to paper or make something in the garage, there's a good chance that they're building something that no one has ever thought of before. And I think it's broadly underappreciated that, particularly in the world of producing complex products, it's essentially infinitely dimensional. So So at any given point, there's essentially infinite freedom to go in any direction. And so after the fact, of course, once you've successfully built some artifact which embodies ideally like value in the marketplace and produces lots of value for its customers, people look back and say, well, you know, I can see that this is derived from that, and this is derived from that, and that's derived from that. And you know, it's completely obvious. It's completely derivative. There's nothing new there at all. But actually, like, you know, from the frontier at any point looking forward, you're generally having a very good day if you have like the slightest clue or a hint or intuition as to which direction you should go. Yeah. And you can only really find out by testing. And that's actually a kind of a broader point there as well, which is like, if you are a hardware entrepreneur, if you go into an area that's sufficiently far from like the frontier or sufficiently weird or sufficiently strange, the market is not efficient at all. Like, until yesterday, I was unaware of anyone else on earth who had even considered building a company around making synthetic gas the same way we are. And then I met one other person. And of course they had read my blog, but and kind of drive that idea. But you would think that, like, well, sometimes like good ideas tend to converge. Like, you know, you see wheelbarrow is invented at the same time printing press is invented at the same time, you know, at the same time Uber was invented, you know, three other companies had the same idea. Of course, if you're on the ground, you see that like Uber started off doing something completely different and moved their way kind of in that direction by chance. But if you're off doing something that, particularly in the hardware space, that's very strange. The odds of accidentally finding out someone else is doing exactly the same thing is basically zero. Like, it's like two people having the same lottery number. It's just the frontier is not efficient at all.
Yeah. This certainly isn't a situation. Hey, if syngas made sense, somebody would already be doing it. It's not one of those.
Well, people have done syngas before. Like, just to be clear, the underlying technology has been around for more than 100 years, and actually, syngas can mean synthesis gas, which is a mix of hydrogen and carbon monoxide. But in this case, I mean synthetic natural gas. And so, for example, there was a project called Store and Go that was done in Europe about 10 years ago, where they made machines that do exactly the same thing our machines do. They take CO2 out of the air, they electrolyze hydrogen, they combine them in a reactor to produce natural gas at pipeline grade. And the only difference between their system and our system is 30 times cheaper.
Yeah, I'm very interested in. So it seems like to get 30 times cheaper, you need sort of like, I don't know if it's fundamental improvement, but significant improvement in electrolyzers, in direct air capture or some form of acquiring carbon, and then the process of combining them. Is there one of those three areas where Terraform is like particularly at the sort of tip of the spear, or is it just all of them? You're just the goal is to just like completely.
We're amazing across the
re-engineer.
Board.
Well, sorry, and Casey, as part of that, just because Duncan kind of framed it up, just for the listener, like, can you explain like the concept behind Terraform, and then maybe answer that question, just like high level, what it's all about.
Actually, if with your indulgence, I will do it the other way around, because the high level thing is going to take a while, and, yeah. And the cost thing actually applies more generally. But basically, like the fundamental reason that Store and Go cost $6 million and us cost $200,000 is not that they used a different material. We both used steel, right? The fundamental reason is that Store and Go was conceived as a project coordinated by a 27-member nation consortium in Europe with several like, you know, cooperating lead engineering companies like Siemens.
This bureaucracy Siemens cost $5.8 million.
Yeah, they won't get out of bed for less than, well, it's just like, so, well, it's more a question of productivity.
It's like ITER.
So the engineers that are doing the work are obviously talented, but like their productivity per unit time is obviously lower, and their cost basis per unit head is obviously higher because there's like overhead costs and so on. But they like, the expectation of productivity in an organization like that is much, much lower. It doesn't have to be that much higher, but it's just like they'll probably spend, you know, in a 40-hour work week, they'll spend 30 of those hours answering emails and doing trainings and talking to people and carrying on. Whereas my engineers here are like, here's your credit card. It has a very high limit to help you move quickly. Go forth and solve this problem in weeks, not years. And that forces them to make really expedient decisions about just deleting huge unnecessary swaths of the thing and not spending all their time in meetings and just increasing the productivity to the absolute limit of like human endurance. And I think this applies across the board. So if you're ever wondering, you know, why is it that I don't want to pick on the Mars rover? I'm going to pick on the Mars rover. Why does the Mars rover cost $2 billion? Well, because you know it costs the labor of 20,000 people, 20,000 person years of labor to produce it. Why does it take 20,000 person years of labor to produce the Mars rover? Well, they spend most of their time talking to each other. They just have to in a project of that size. It's just inherently inefficient. But if you can build with a very small team, all in one place on a shoestring budget, you can get it done. So that's the key. Now, your other question was like, what is the point? What is the whole thing? The Terraformer is a machine that converts sunlight and air into sustainable, synthetic, cheap natural gas. And how it works under the hood is kind of immaterial in a way, because atoms go in one direction, in one end, and the same atoms come out the other direction the other end in a slightly different configuration. But for the nerds among your listeners, I guess I'll go into a little bit of detail. There's three fundamental components. There's an electrolyzer that converts water into hydrogen and oxygen, which we vent. It's our waste product. There is a direct air capture system that captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That's our source of carbon. And then there's a Sabatier reactor that combines carbon dioxide with hydrogen to produce CH4, which is methane or natural gas, and also water vapor, which we condense out and also vent or dispose of. We can recycle it if we have to. So it all sounds very simple at that high level. This is kind of these three components just have to play nicely together, and the whole thing works.
Go on.
Pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Yeah, like it's kind of my wildest dream was like one day I'll get to play a role in the development of like one cool piece of technology. And then I went and started a company where like, if we don't successfully develop all three of these pieces of technology by the same time, we're in deep trouble.
Electrolysis not even thinking about this from like a physics informed perspective, but just sort of like a popular perspective, sounds energy intensive, right? And DAC sounds energy intensive. Mm-hmm. What is like at the, maybe not at the true limit, but at the maybe reasonable limit, you know, if I have 100 megawatts of solar, how much gas am I getting out of this thing? Like what's sort of the efficiency one might be able to expect?
So if your baseline expectation is I drill a hole in the ground in Texas and infinite volumes of gas come flying out, then you're going to be disappointed by a Terraformer because it's limited by energy conservation. And sunlight is inherently a diffuse, kind of a diffuse energy source that we kind of successfully concentrate through these steps. First the solar array and then the hydrogen electrolyzer. The stream of hydrogen that's coming out of the electrolyzer, like I can't remember what it is, like 2,000 standard liters a minute or something. That's a lot of energy. It's effectively, it's a good fraction of all the energy that the sun has dropped on, 5 acres of land all at once. But if you compare it as a baseline against biofuels, where you're using, large swaths of land to capture solar energy to produce reduced carbon chemicals, principally hydrocarbons, sugars and stuff that you can convert into gas or oil or plastics, it's almost 100 times more productive. It depends on how economically productive or like agriculturally productive your mm-hmm. your farm is. But like compared to the absolute best corn growing area on earth and the best season ever, it's 20 times better. And compared to your RMS farm, it's hundreds of times better. And so that's really compelling from an economic point of view because not only is your product not like corn or soy, which can spoil and kind of has its various product price fluctuations and is generally overproduced. It's a hydrocarbon, which is always in demand. And your productivity is, 100 or a couple hundred times higher on per unit basis and per area basis. And then also you don't need to worry about, pesticides and crop dusters and irrigation and water rights and stuff like that.
That was very Václav Smil. That was,
I'll take that as a compliment. To answer that directly. One megawatt electrolyzer is the, sorry, one megawatt Terraformer is the fundamental subunit because that's matched to a 1 megawatt solar array, which is the typical kind of industrial scale deployment. And that will produce you about 6,500 cubic feet of natural gas per day, which at the going rate is about $20 of revenue, which does not sound like very much. But then natural gas prices are unfairly depressed right now, or like unsustainably depressed right now. That's every day of the year. So for example, if you're growing corn as a biofuel, you only get to harvest it once or twice a year. And so this thing produces, to a good approximation, it produces like a harvest worth of fuel every day. and then for a 100 megawatt system, it'd be 100 times as much. Whatever that works out to, like 200 million cubic feet per year or something like that. Again, it's like, it's kind of small potatoes in the grand scheme of things at that scale. In order to supply all of US oil and gas consumption, you need about 40 terawatts for oil and gas of solar production, which is a very, very large number, to be clear. It's something like 5% of US land would have to be converted to solar production to meet this demand. But on the other hand, something like 50% of US land is devoted solely to like cows. So it's relatively small in comparison to existing agricultural uses, which are significantly more environmentally impactful as well.
Yeah, relative to its value, 5% of land's not crazy.
Right.
Is there an engineering advantage that Terraform can sort of extract by virtue of focusing specifically on solar as the input? And I'll take it a step further. When I look at the sort of large legacy industrial players who are developing electrolyzers, it appears most of them are focused on running these things at like 90% capacity factors from the grid to like extract credits from some government. By focusing on a source that's whatever, you know, 20, 30% capacity factor, something like that, does that fundamentally change how you engineer the product? Really, you need lower CapEx, but like, do you have from top down, you're like sort of thinking about the electrolyzer differently?
Yeah, for sure. So first of all, like we can run this off the grid if you really want to. You're probably unlikely to produce cost competitive hydrogen if you do that, but you could. And if someone comes along with a nuclear reactor that can produce power at $10 a megawatt hour, well, I'll be first in line to buy one. But the reason we went to solar, there's a couple of reasons. Well, the first is solar is pretty much everywhere. Even places that you don't think of as conventionally like solar rich or resource rich, there's enough solar power there with like very, very, very few exceptions anywhere on the earth that's actually populated. The exception, of course, is the UK, but you know, on them more later. And then the other reason is, of course, you know, if you're saying, well, we need 20 terawatts or 40 terawatts, or to do the whole world 400 terawatts, well, good luck finding 400 terawatts of uranium in the crust to build that many nuclear reactors, even if you could build them, you know, profitably, which is dubious at best. But with solar, it's just like copy paste. We already understand industries that routinely like plow 30% of the earth's surface to produce crops. So it's like it's very much kind of within that zone or within that range. And then as far as adapting to solar on an engineering basis goes, so that's kind of a cost basis or a scaling basis. But as far as engineering basis goes, well, the cost is the obvious one. The electrolyzer needs to be super cheap to make up for the low utilization. But funnily enough, you know, if you make it the cheapest electrolyzer you can, it's actually kind of unnaturally well suited to solar anyway. Sorry. It's unnaturally well suited to solar anyway. And the main challenge with powering electrolyzer off solar power is that most electrolyzers do not like to be throttled. And it's conventional wisdom. I just got off a call with a good friend of mine, who knows a lot about electrolyzers, and they were very surprised to hear that we were using an alkaline electrolyzer because everyone knows you can't throttle an alkaline electrolyzer. Well, we can, and we do. We can flip it on and off like a light switch if we want to. Just like get my toddler in here and have them like flick, 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 turn it on and off. And it doesn't harm it because we've deleted all the components that would be harmed by ramping the power up and down, which is super cool. And we've actually run an electrolyzer coupled directly to a solar array with no intervening power electronics, which is also critical for hitting the cost thresholds that we need. So, you know, you don't need $400 a kilowatt of power electronics. You can actually get down. You know, if you think like, what are the super cheap power intensive appliances in your house? The one that I have in mind is like a toaster or an electric kettle. And you can actually buy an electric kettle, like a, you know, hot water boiling machine or a rice cooker or something for, you know, 20, 30, 40 bucks that consumes a kilowatt of power. And their control systems are typically a switch, you know, with a rice cooker, it might have a little button somewhere. And some buttons and stuff to press rice or vegetables or something. But like, if you can produce an electric kettle for $15 a kilowatt, then you can ship it from China for that price. And it includes warranty, although, you know, at least notionally, why the hell should an electrolyzer, which is basically just a glorified water heater with a switch, cost $1,500 per kilowatt? Like, that seems crazy to me. And it just kind of, I think, like, this simple comparison shows that there's an awful lot of room to improve as far as electrolyzer design goes. Now, our internal cost is under $100 a kilowatt right now, but, like, damned if we don't get down to about $20 eventually.
So when you look at, like, the distribution across the electrolyzer and DAC and everything there, like, is there a threshold at which you're not getting continuous power output from the solar? So, like, how do you think about, like, the distribution of power output from the solar into the various components?
Most of our components are pretty power intensive, and they are designed to turn on when the sun comes up and turn off when the sun goes down. About 80% of the power goes into DAC, and 80% of the power goes into electrolysis. Almost all the rest goes into DAC. Something like, you know, a kilowatt or two goes into power electronics, computers and stuff like that. That's like less than 1%. And that's about the right split as well, because, you know, for every hydrogen molecule, every hydrogen atom that goes into this reactor, hydrogen molecule, you've got one CO2 molecule going. So back up. One CO2 molecule needs four hydrogen molecules to make one molecule of methane. So so like 4-1 is roughly right as far as the power split goes, mm-hmm. as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Like you could probably do DAC with half the power, but it would only reduce the cost of your product by like 5%. Is that really worth your while? No.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's how the split works.
It's interesting. So there's so much focus on DAC as a standalone technology as well today, the purpose of just sequestration. Yeah. I'm curious, one, if Terraform is successful, would you just sell your DAC machine? And two, yeah, do you think, for sure, there's a market there? Like, what do you think about just like the DAC industry as it appears to potentially be emerging? Or do you think it will be more so focused on like productive uses of that carbon concentration?
Well, I think as far as standalone products go, the most obvious one for us would be the electrolyzer, because there's an awful lot more demand for green hydrogen than there is for directly captured CO2. And in fact, when we talk to potential customers, most of them already have CO2 and they want to do something with it. There is, of course, you know, I wouldn't even say quite industry. There's probably half a dozen or so startups that are looking seriously at DAC. and we know who they are. We're friendly, obviously. And you know, if they're doing direct air capture with carbon sequestration, then they're kind of chasing the voluntary carbon market, which is, you know, not tiny, but it's also not super huge. So like they would have to find other sources of growth beyond a certain point. And I think it's also fair to say that under the rules of economics as we understand them, it's unlikely that the voluntary carbon market will be able to grow to a scale that's meaningful as far as the climate challenge is concerned. It can certainly help bootstrap DAC technology, for example, which is something we're grateful for. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, it's very, very difficult, very, very difficult to do direct capture of CO2 as a waste stream from combustion after the fact. Like, it's kind of like closing the barn door after the horse is already bolted. One thing that is true across the political spectrum, in, you know, United States, China, everywhere in between, is that consumers are extremely sensitive to increases in the price of their gasoline, and, you know, imposing the sort of costs necessary to do direct air capture with carbon sequestration on the user at the point of sale or as a tax after the fact or via, you know, quantitative easing, like basically printing money, would be completely unsustainable and you know, unelectable policy. So if you want to do DAC, you have to put it upstream of the point of sale. Right. You have to make DAC part of the value creation step, which means you have to turn the DAC into something that people actually want to buy. And there are a bunch of companies out there that are turning it into various high value chemicals, and they're good for them. You know, it's like more dollars per carbon atom captured, then that's great. But you know, essentially, I quit my job at JPL to do the hard thing, and the hard thing is you solve the whole problem. You know, basically, go and address the single largest market for carbon products at the lowest possible price, and fight like demons, as they say, to make that work financially. You know, even though our revenue per carbon atom might be 10 times lower than the revenue of some other company that might be making, you know, carbon neutral vodka or something. At the end of the day, the overall market for carbon neutral vodka won't really make a difference on the climate side. Whereas, or actually, even as far as climate goes, I mean, you probably have a handful of listeners who don't care that much about climate. What I'm really motivated by is human welfare. And cheap oil is the best antidote to poverty that humanity has ever known. In fact, it's the only one. If you look at the kind of oil extraction as a function of time and global poverty as a function of time, coal didn't solve poverty, but oil did. And I think, you know, the obvious prescription for the future of humanity is to increase the amount of oil per person available as much as possible. But obviously, there's only so much on the ground. We need to make some more of it.
That is a great segue of somewhere that I want to go with the conversation. Before we do, is the basic math essentially the trade-off of reduced utilization of an electrolyzer and you know, direct air carbon capture, the free fuel from the solar and the not need to like pay for interconnection and distribution of power, or of like, you know, selling your carbon on the market, like you have to distribute that somehow because it's all self-contained. Yep. that like free fuel plus lack of interconnection costs or like the infrastructure needed to deliver power or something like that.
Yeah.
Aside from all the important points you're making on like making electrolyzers cheaper, which seems to be true as well, is that like the essential trade-off? And like how does that math work? You know, getting 30% utilization versus 90, but you don't have to pay for all this other stuff, essentially, like fuel and interconnection.
Yeah. I'll avoid punching my microphone onto the ground. So we're basically seeking to do a clean substitution on the upstream oil and gas supply side. And in order to do that, we can't afford too many galaxy brain thoughts on like, well, what if we just switched over our entire economy to hydrogen or ammonia or DME or methanol or something as a fundamental energy source? And of course, you know, if humanity had come of age on a planet where methanol was the primary source of energy available, then sure, fine. We would have infrastructure that's prepared to deal with that. But we're in the business of getting to scale as quickly as possible, which means meeting the market where it's at. And that means providing fuels that are, you know, drop-in substitutes, cross-compatible with existing existing usages. And that means natural gas and gasoline products. and sure, there's demand for quite a bit of hydrogen out there as well. And we can serve that demand. But I think it's significantly more unreasonable to expect that, you know, any country on earth, let alone every country on earth, would, you know, roll out a national pipeline network for hydrogen just so that we could transport our hydrogen from our, you know, solar powered electrolyzer over there to our solar powered DAC over there. And when in fact we can, it's actually quite elegant to integrate all three of these things into a single combined package that sits in the electrolyzer, in the solar array. And produces natural gas as though it was a gas well that someone had drilled, and then distribute that gas through existing pipelines to existing customers when they don't even notice the difference. It seems to me like that's the minimum friction approach. There are of course a handful of places on Earth where there is a bit of infrastructure as far as like CO2 pipelines go, and we're happy to use that, you know, in those areas. But again, like you could completely saturate those pipelines and you wouldn't make a dent in the climate problem or the energy supply problem. At all.
What about totally off-grid solutions?
Yeah.
Like, could you store the natural gas on site, put it through? I'm like, future scale off-grid microgrid.
We have had some questions about that. The thing is, like, I think it's probably fair to say, like, the dominant users of natural gas now and in the future are like major industrial users, and they're mm-hmm. typically already very well connected to distribution infrastructure. That said, I could imagine like a new build ammonia plant needs a source of hydrogen. We could do solar hydrogen for them. And I do very much like the idea of like completely like grid islanded, off grid stuff. But again, like if you needed gasoline to run your truck, it would probably make more sense to make gasoline. Although of course there are actually relatively inexpensive conversions for natural gas to run automotive vehicles. So like for Kazakhstan, for example, and in Australia when I was a kid, there were a lot of vehicles running on LNG or CNG.
Yeah.
So, and I think that actually LNG, it's already being adopted increasingly as a fuel in shipping. And I would expect in the future, particularly if we have a renaissance of high performance, you know, supersonic passenger aviation, that it would be a lot of it would be looking to use LNG as a fuel for that as well. So I guess it's hard to predict exactly what the future will bring. But what I can say with certainty is that the market for both natural gas and for gasoline will be in the trillions of dollars. And we will happily serve both markets to the extent of our ability and the extent of our customers to pay us, which is, yeah, it's a nice way of basically letting the market solve that problem for you.
What Colleen's question makes me think about is, like, if we're talking about the elegance of the engineering solution, let's bring all these things together, right? Rather than use solar to power electrolysis, to make hydrogen, to ship hydrogen somewhere, to make, you know, to then solar power DAC, to, like, let's just bring it all together. If I'm thinking about like beachhead markets for something like this, where perhaps the dollar per MMBTU of this gas is a little higher than what just like basically flows out of the ground in Texas, is there an elegance to say, if I want to build a new fertilizer plant, do it in the desert with a bunch of Terraform units and a giant solar array, and actually go straight to the fertilizer output?
Yes, of course. Yeah, so the job
as opposed
of the...
to sort of like pumping Terraform's gas just like into some pipeline somewhere and hoping someone will pay a little extra for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a number of different companies that have started to try and address the fertilizer problem. So, so for example, you could start off with natural gas and you convert that to hydrogen using the reverse water gas shift reaction, and then proceed from there to make your ammonia. Or you can actually pyrolyze natural gas either electrically or thermally if you want to have carbon-free hydrogen, and then you just end up with a bunch of carbon black you have to dispose of somehow, but you make a giant pile of it, it's stable. or you could, you know, potentially make green hydrogen and then pipe that into a plant which is doing centralized cryogenic distillation of nitrogen from the atmosphere to make ammonia in that plant, and then ship the ammonia from there to, or make the fertilizer, you know, some ammonium nitrate or whatever, and then ship that to your local farmers or whatever. So there's obviously many ways of skinning that cat. But I will say that I do not project a massive increase in demand for ammonia, like nitrogen-based fertilizer. And so like the existing, you know, kind of like one of the problems that we face is like, how do we take existing industry, which already consumes an awful lot of hydrocarbons and fossil fuels, and reduce their impact without having to, like, basically rebuild our entire industrial stack at considerable cost? You know, like, you and I enjoy cheap food, and we enjoy cheap cement, and we enjoy cheap steel. And part of the reason it's cheap is that all the machinery that produces it, as polluting as it is already paid off. And actually, one of the neatest and cleanest ways to drastically reduce the carbon environmental impacts, at least, of legacy infrastructure is to do a clean upstream replacement of their fuel source, which is what we're working on. But of course, you know, there's a mob in Sweden that's producing, I think, H2 green steel, and they have a hydroelectric power source for hydrogen production, and we've had talks, you know, productive talks with them about producing hydrogen or some blend of hydrogen and their natural gas to help them run their direct iron reduction plant or whatever. But like, I don't have a deep opinion as to which way that goes, as long as someone figures out a good way of doing it that produces, you know, high quality metals at low prices. That's all I want.
So the first Terraform customer is just as likely to be just the natural gas pipeline wholesale market as it is
for sure. That's the most obvious market for us to serve. And we spent most of our effort talking to like utilities in the United States and other countries, because they're already set up to buy gas from other pipelines or from tens of thousands of upstream producers.
I mean, I would even love to see, like, because it's such a small self-contained unit, like, I've always joked in the past how people are sleeping on how incredible solar is. Like, the equivalent would be you'd need, you know, to drill a well, you need a refinery and you need an engine to like get work out of if you were thinking of like a self-contained homestead or something, right? But you're actually saying, like, compare that, if you even are lucky enough to have an oil well in your backyard,
or an oil resource, versus like shipping diesel from California to Hawaii, or the cost versus the cost of like plopping down a Terraform and like running your work truck if you're like live on an island, right? Like I'm like very curious.
Hawaii's interesting, isn't it?
Looks like, you know, like why don't you just create the gas right in your backyard with some solar and then use that for work?
Yeah, for sure. So there's two aspects of that. Hawaii's very interesting. So you guys no doubt will have heard over and over again that like, oh, solar is impossible. You can't make solar work. You can't make your grid work. And yet, you know, my dad has a small yacht that runs off solar power, and isolated houses all over the world run off solar power. And Hawaii, particularly Kauai, largely runs off solar power now, bit of wind. And in the case of Hawaii, it's actually an interesting case because no one ever has to drive all that far there. There's not that far to go. So you can actually like drive, you know, old school short range electric cars or golf buggies around completely electrically. There's relatively little industry on Hawaii that actually depends on hydrocarbons. So it's actually a pretty good like test case for, you could go almost pure electrification there, and maybe a bit of biofuel, and like, that'd be pretty sick. I think someone should try that. unless someone's like, oh, Honolulu, I've got to set up like, you know, a massive plastic manufacturing plant there or something. In which case, by all means, roll out some more solar. Actually, Hawaii is an interesting use case. If you did want to do carbon sequestration, volcanic islands are a great place to do it. So you could build mines on you know, Mauna Kea and just dig up like, you know, hundreds of millions of tons of lava that's otherwise not doing anything, and grind it up and throw it in the ocean. And that would actually do by far the most cost effective job of vacuuming up CO2 from the air and putting it once again into the crust where it belongs and where it needs to be long term. the other kind of thing you touched on there is this question of like, a broader question of like, how far does energy travel between like, or forms of energy travel from the point where they're generated to the point where they're consumed? And just for some historical context here, you know, prior to say 1700 or even more recently, I mean, basically the invention of the train and later refrigeration, food was always locally produced because it just went off. So all cities were essentially fed from farms that were within a day's walk of their outskirts. Yeah. With just a tiny handful of exceptions. So ancient Rome, for example, had an extensive logistics network to bring in grain, and that many of the citizens were poor people who lived primarily on a grain based diet from Egypt or whatever. But almost always they were deriving their food locally from agriculture, and this was not exactly like modern fertilized highly productive industrial agriculture. And yet the population density of most of these places has not changed all that much since the invention of refrigeration, mostly because, you know, birth rates fell at about the same time as refrigeration was invented, probably not coincidentally. So the upshot is that, you know, if your city in Europe, for example, or in the United States was able to be agriculturally self-sufficient 200 years ago, then it can sure as hell be energy self-sufficient, either via direct electrification with solar and batteries or with synthetic fuel, by deploying solar panels almost directly outside your city. And people will turn around and say, well, that's impossible. Everyone knows that fuel comes from Saudi Arabia. It has to come on a ship for 10,000 miles. I'll say, no, let's think about that for a minute. And they'll say, well, that's impossible. It's not enough land. I'm like, well, there's enough land to feed, you know, essentially the same population here 200 years ago with people farming by hand. There's sure as hell enough land to feed everyone now, plus, you know, have enough solar panels, which, as I mentioned before, like, you know, hundreds of times more productive on an energy basis and a per area basis than you know, pre-industrial agriculture, probably thousands of times more productive than pre-industrial agriculture. So actually like the vision for the future is one in which almost all the world's cities are surrounded by you know, a relatively discrete area, a small area of solar panels, some of which are doing a direct electric, you know, power supply, and some of which are doing synthetic fuel production and synthetic chemical production in general for that city's demand. And then you may retain, you know, some vestige of a legacy grid to move power around between local areas, you know, at a small volume, something like the, you know, the legacy telephone exchange or internet distribution. But you know, maybe, I don't know, just to pick it up, 5% of like average consumption can be moved from city to city. But you certainly don't need to like go and build a continent spanning network of hydrogen pipelines or ammonia pipelines or, you know, 5x the size of the grid in order to make this work. Now, I have a blog post on this, but yeah, there's this idea that you absolutely have to do that. But all these studies were done back before solar and batteries got really, really cheap. And when solar and batteries get really, really cheap, it changes everything. You know, you no longer have to have like wind turbines all across the country and a massive grid to make sure that no one ever runs out of power. And in fact, batteries are, you know, I have to go into some detail here, but like, batteries are significantly more you know, lucrative, significantly more value generating for consumers than transmission lines are in terms of ensuring that you have power available when you need it, which is one of the reasons why battery manufacturing and deployment is growing 30% year on year and the grid is actually shrinking. It's almost like capitalism solves this problem. Amazing.
Why don't you guys have a battery with embedded in your system and then you like oversize the solar?
Yeah. Well, say freeze the size of the solar and change the size of all the machinery. So you have a solar array connected to a battery. And if the battery is like, I don't know, 18 megawatt hours, a quarter of 18 megawatt hours, 4.5 megawatt hours, then you can run your 250 kilowatt electrolyzer 24 hours a day instead of a 1 megawatt electrolyzer 6 hours a day. Does that save you money? Well, your electrolyzer costs $80 a kilowatt. So instead of spending $80 a kilowatt, you spend $20 a kilowatt. So you save $60 a kilowatt. Now, how much does your battery cost for 4.5 megawatt hour battery? Well, thousands and thousands of dollars. And maybe batteries will get cheaper in the future, but they're not going to get as cheap as my ultra cheap.
Oversize the electrolyzer.
So you can basically run that trade across the system, and it turns out that with one exception, it's better to go to sleep when the sun goes down. The exception to that is the CO2 absorption bed, because that's just the only power required there is a fan that blows air through it, and the fan does not consume very much power.
Mm.
So your long-term view of the energy system is electricity, which is produced for the use of electricity, may be relatively local, and then any longer span energy transportation is probably in chemical form.
No, I think chemical energy will be produced locally as well.
Well, that as well. Yeah, yep. Sorry. But
the long distance transport of energy will be container ships, cargo ships, and planes. And that's just to carry their own energy.
Okay, so you're actually seeing, it's not just that we don't need HVDC lines across the entire US making this giant network. We also probably don't need giant pipelines in the future either.
Well, we already have them in the US, but not all parts of the world have the giant pipeline networks. And I don't think they need to go and build them in order to join the modern world. It's just like, Africa didn't have to go and build a national network of copper, telephone wires in order to get mobile phones. They just set up, cell towers and pretty soon they'll be setting up satellite. Starlink enabled cell towers, and that drastically reduces the cost of delivering high bandwidth broadband internet services across the world. You don't have to put the copper in the ground, and the same thing goes to the pipeline. So my expectation is that in the United States, where there's already a pretty big grid and a pretty big national pipeline network both for gas and oil, that within 30 years or so, that network will start to be pruned. They'll start cutting it down.
There's a really
same with the rail network.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I've been thinking about this as you've been talking. On the one hand, you're a solar maxi, and actually, I'm in that like build energy WhatsApp as well with you, and I always appreciate you're just like such a solar bull. And they're like, it's a bunch of nuclear people for the most part.
Build energy is a lot of nuclear bros. And I don't get me wrong. I don't hate nuclear power. I've got some tritium in my bedroom. I taught nuclear physics for a year at Caltech. I know my way around the radiation table. But I think the major challenge for nuclear energy is just cost. It's not personal. It's just business. Solar is great. We're going to pave the world.
I've been trying to square that, like, on the one hand, you may sound like a Mark Jacobson bro, and that he's definitely like all about HVDC and stuff. It's like very solar maximalist in a lot of ways, solar and storage. On the other hand, EACC is decidedly like very anti, or not anti-solar, but they're typically like more nuclear. And you tweeted today about how the solar, the world's going to be covered in solar panels and like AI data centers for AI, which like sounds EACC, but not. And so like you found this very interesting seam between these like two worlds that seem opposed. And it sounds like your view, like what the view there is, just that like wires are very expensive. Like that's how you come to that place, essentially.
Yeah.
Am I synthesizing that well, or?
Well, Well, I mean, aspects of EAC are kind of aesthetic, you know, and, yeah, and they don't need to be. And I don't really define my points of view as like, oh, I'm EA or I'm EAC or whatever. I'm just like,
what
I say in my blog, I think is true for now. But there was a broader point here. Nope, it's a long day and it's gone. You can try and reprompt me, but I'm dying here.
You don't like wires, was the what I think.
I don't like wires. Oh yeah, it's a good point there. Yeah, thanks. Okay, let me tell you why I hate wires. Actually, I like wires. Wires are pretty cool.
So, and Mark Jacobson would like wires is the connecting point there, because he's like, build big solar, build wires, that type of stuff, you know.
So the funny thing is, it's, I don't know about Mark Jacobson. I'm sure he's done some calculations, but I'd say it's actually relatively rare for people to actually sit down and do the calculations. But the fundamental, there's actually kind of this interesting thing going on, which is take an existing grid and then start dropping solar and batteries on it, and it really messes up the grid. Like, in the same way that like Uber messed up taxis, because because it's just a better system, and it basically takes, like, the previous grid was a stable attractor by default, but once you put solar and batteries on there, the previous grid and the legacy generating infrastructure and the legacy transmission infrastructure just becomes stranded asset. And to make this obvious, let's say I have a model town somewhere, and it's being powered by a high voltage transmission line for a neighboring power plant or neighboring town. Plus this, you're installing batteries, right? So you're installing batteries. The batteries have this nice twice a day arbitrage on solar power. And so they're making a shitload of money, and you install some more batteries. Now, as you install more batteries, your ability to compensate for like local solar effects occurring, like, you know, some bad weather or something like that, increases. As that happens, your utilization of the power line, of the high voltage transmission line, is decreasing. So over time, its revenue is decreasing. And like, we're just talking about like, oh, you want to have assets where you got high utilization. Well, your batteries you're using twice a day, and your solar you're using every day, and your transmission line, initially, maybe you're using it on average like 2 months of the year. And after you put in a bunch of batteries, now you're using it 2 weeks of the year. And after you put a bunch more batteries in, all of which are making money, by the way, you may be using the transmission line 2 days a year. Now, is that really making money? No. And another way of thinking of that, this is like, maybe initially you can finance a 1,000-kilometer long transmission line. And that's great, because, you know, you get a lot of like weather decorrelation over 1,000 kilometers. But after you put in a bunch of batteries, maybe like the price parity point is only 100 kilometers, maybe it's 10 kilometers. 10 kilometers, you know, same storm here and there. Like, there's no longer any benefit to having the transmission line. So it's very, very clear that like batteries and solar are here to eat the lunch of everything else. Like, and there's nothing they can do about it. Right. It's just a matter of time. I'm trying to think of an analogy here, but it's kind of like what happened to sailing ships after container ships came along. Like, it's just they're better and more competitive on every axis, and there's not much that the sailing ships can do about it.
So would you say if the US were to engage in a grid new deal, you know, sort of a national effort to build out the super grid, and insulate that from sort of competitive capitalistic price effects and such, just like, let's just build it, that would probably be a mistake. That would be there would be a lot of stranded assets involved in that endeavor.
I believe that would be a mistake. I believe it would be an extremely politically costly as well as financially costly mistake. Now, of all of my crazy ideas that I talk about in my blog, this is one of my least popular ones. So I will caveat this by saying that I know and respect a number of people who disagree with me on this point, but I think ultimately I will be proven to be correct on this front. I think that if you're going to burn a bunch of political well, like doing permitting reform and trampling on private property owners' rights with the sort of eminent domain you need to greatly increase the size of the grid, you'd be better off using that same political capital to do permitting reform and making it easier to deploy solar. And again, like, I'm going to jump on my soapbox here for a minute, but like, it's absolutely crazy to me that the number one factor slowing down deployment of solar in the United States and actually across much of the Western world are environmental protection regulations that are not designed necessarily to protect the environment. Like, these were signed into law by Nixon. They're designed to protect the human environment. They're designed to safeguard clean air and clean water. And right now in the United States, we have four or 5,000 people die every year prematurely from the effects of air pollution caused by legacy power generating plants alone, right? We're not talking about, you know, air pollution from cars. We're not talking about air pollution from smoking cigarettes. We're talking about air pollution from legacy power plants. It's like a 9/11 every seven months. These people are dying. They're leaving behind their families. They're often suffering terribly because, you know, as you probably appreciate, post-COVID, lung failure is not a good way to go. And every single gigawatt of solar power that we deploy saves about 400 lives, about 100 lives per year that we are able to deploy it. And because every gigawatt of solar that we want to deploy is delayed by 4 years by mostly EPA, actually not even like legal EPA regulations. These are regulations that were kind of added to the law after the fact through common practice and through regulation. Basically it takes 4 years to install a solar array. So we are literally killing 400 people for every gigawatt of solar that we refuse to put on like some otherwise empty and largely underutilized patch of desert in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And it blows my mind that more people are not outraged by this. It's absolutely insane to me that like the one technology that is going to solve the climate problem and protect our environment and would actually deliver massive short-term positive impacts on human health is like repeatedly kicked in the nuts by, of all things, environmental protection regulations. And that is the one thing we should be spending our political capital trying to fix. We got so close there. I think Manchin was almost over the line around the same time as the IRA went through. But anyway, capitalism is going to solve this problem. We are going to pave the world with solar sooner or later anyway. And by pave, I mean, 5 to 10%. But the sooner the better, wouldn't it be amazing? China has managed to clean up the smogginess of their cities largely. And yet here we are in the United States with 5,000 Americans dying every year because we can't get out of our own way. Anyway, slash rant.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree on the permitting. It's pretty, pretty wild. I am going to have to drop early, but I will say love wires.
as a DR
maximalist.
Sorry,
I still think there's like an important insurance component that is probably worth paying for, but understanding that it won't be utilized appropriately.
Well, so you can, there's always an opportunity cost, right? So you can say, well, I've got $100 million to spend on grid infrastructure this year. And if I spend it on wires, then I will increase my reliability from 99% to 99.2%. And if I spend it on batteries, I'll increase my reliability from 99% to 99.9%. Your choice. And it's very clear that some mixture of these is optimal, and that mixture currently today strongly favors batteries, and batteries are getting cheaper over time, but wires are not. I don't necessarily think this means that in the future we're all just going to have rooftop solar and a garage-mounted synthetic fuel plant. I still think there's going to be some degree of centralization, probably at the city level. So you'll still have large power lines blocking out your view within the city. Don't worry. But in terms of like stringing wires all the way across the earth, so as to
we underground here. Don't worry.
you can string them underground as well, but the same way, like basically like attract the wrath of the sun when it has a huge coronal mass ejection, so you can induce massive currents. It's kind of cool. It's very Benjamin Franklin. I don't know. It seems surplus to requirements.
So you're still long the local distribution utility, just not necessarily like the super grid notion.
Yeah. So if you say, well, let's put as many solar panels in sensible places as we can until we've saturated our demand for electricity. In most cities, in most of the world, it is rooftop solar plus a fair bit of solar, in industrial scale plants outside the city. But like maybe rooftop solar meets half your demand. So like overnight, half your demand for electricity transmission goes away. Right. Overnight, the average distance that electricity travels from the point that you generate it to the point you consume it goes down by a factor of half, by a factor of two. I think that's super compelling. Thanks, Colleen.
See you, Colleen. With you.
And sorry to break your dreams. does anyone else have any precious ideas that I can trample on and destroy? I'm happy to destroy dreams today.
I just realized I've been on this podcast arguing about franchise rights for like 2 years, which is still building more wires, and you're just like, no, it's just gonna shrink and we're gonna prune the grid. Don't worry about that. I think that's kind of an awesome thing.
It just seems to me that like it's not a good allocation of capital, right? Like capital is finite.
Yeah.
And sure, the government can like cut checks to build all kinds of useless infrastructure if they want. But at the end of the day, like it's one thing to spend trillions of dollars on a national highway network that, but like,
I think Quincy's point on the last podcast was like, he's, sort of a grid edge maximalist in a lot of ways that you are, but it sounds like in a sense, like coupled with load growth, he doesn't believe that you can get solar dense enough at the grid edge to actually have, obviously a battery will like reduce the capacity of the wires, but unless you can actually get enough like generation at the grid edge, that you'll still need some degree of wires capacity that he thinks will get exceeded at some point.
Yeah, so there's a lot of very interesting work going on at like basically trying to improve the utilization of wires by, I mean, without loss of generality, putting a battery at both ends and one in the middle. And I think that's kind of cool in that, like, batteries, yeah, while they're in the process of destroying the business case for wires, are at the same time also helping the existing wires along. But like at the end of the day, it's just batteries. It's like battery. You can't escape them. And you know, I think that's a worthy goal, particularly if usage, like generation and consumption patterns are changing. And for example, you know, you've got a legacy transmission line from here to Mojave, and you want to put twice as much power through it. Well, you know, that you have to find some way of doing that within, you know, the local area of a city. And of course, Los Angeles is one of the world's largest cities, so it's going to have, you know, broader solar catchment area outside it, despite our amazing solar resource here. But in general, when you're talking like, well, you know, the sort of transmission lines that actually, there's not even all that many of them, but like this, actually, like my pet peeve is people who are like, oh my goodness, there are many, many, I'm going to be rude now because I'm tired, but there are many, many European energy galaxy brains who are like, oh well, Europe has always been short of energy. It's never caused a problem before other than World War I and World War II. But the way we're going to solve this problem is we're going to import the energy from Russia. Oh, actually, that didn't work out. Now we're going to import the energy from the United States. That cannot possibly go wrong. Oh, is that?
Yeah.
US natural gas production is already declining even before we got our import terminal online. Okay. I guess we'll do neocolonialism in North Africa. We'll build a lot of solar arrays in the Sahara Desert, and then we'll put transmission lines, high voltage DC transmission lines under the Mediterranean Sea across a you know, a major geological fault line, and then we'll land it in Italy, where nothing ever goes wrong with regards to infrastructure, aside from bridges falling down. And this will be great. This will be fine. And why are you doing that? Well, because it's really sunny in the Sahara Desert. Really? Have you been there? No, but I saw it in Star Wars once. Okay, great. How much sunnier is it than like southern Italy? Oh, about 20% sunnier. Oh, wow. That makes a huge difference. So people, when they think of energy, they're like, oh, well, Saudi Arabia's got 10,000 times more energy than everywhere else. Therefore, energy is always something you have to go to Saudi Arabia to get.
Yeah.
Or like some other sunny, sandy place. No, the reality is, even with the exception of the United Kingdom, and sucks to be the United Kingdom, and a handful of small Nordic countries that don't really have major industrial demand for hydrocarbons or energy, the entire world's population lives somewhere where their grandparents were able to walk, to grow food, to live, which means that there is enough solar energy there to power their entire civilization at current levels of hydrocarbon consumption with money to spare, right? The number of places on Earth where this is not true is vanishingly small. Essentially, if all those places continue to burn fossil hydrocarbons that make no difference whatsoever to climate, 99.99% of the world's population can be addressed with local electricity. And by local, I mean like walking distance electricity and synthetic fuel production. Even Germany, like Germany's like, oh, you know, they want to import the, and the thing is like you say, okay, well, the solar resource in Australia is, I don't know, 30 or 40% better than Germany. Okay, good for Australia. So does that make sense to like pave Australia with solar panels, convert that energy into synthetic, I don't know, hydrocarbons or ammonia, and then ship that all the way to Europe to get that energy? No, because solar panels are 15-20% cheaper per year. Wait 3 years and it's the same price in Europe. So
no, like, I mean, power is enormously expensive to ship. And it also seems, you know, that it seems obvious to me that if, and I've actually, I wrote an article once just talking about how, you know, electrification and decarbonization is a deglobalizing force, because it's really cheap to ship oil from Saudi Arabia. You can't do the same with power at all. Like, it's insanely expensive to ship. So
yeah,
obviously we're going to produce energy. Fuel. Right. Well, there you go.
Or like other energy dense products. So I'm Australian, and it pains me deeply that Australia has not got their act together on this, because they will always have a better solar resource than anywhere else and better mineral resources than anywhere else. And still what Australia does, they dig up bauxite in northern Queensland, they ship it to China to be turned into aluminum. And then it gets shipped, I'm talking about Australia, it's aluminium. And then it gets shipped back to Australia. And so like basically what Australia made less than a cent on selling to China comes back as an iPhone chassis for $100. And guess where all that profit goes? Not to Australia. So like, why the hell doesn't Australia set up solar powered or metal refining and processing and manufacturing facilities? I think inevitably,
manufacturing will move to the sun, basically, or wind or whatever it is. Like it has to.
Well, I would like it to, but Australia is a small country and is largely resistant to market forces, unfortunately.
Yeah.
We will see.
So
we will see.
Overall, kind of like the summarizing point here is basically the diffuse nature of solar energy is enormously disruptive as we switch toward it.
Yeah.
And all of these models of like energy systems and value flow will massively change based on just that simple fact. The sun's pretty much everywhere.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, it's like 173,000 terawatts of solar energy hits the earth at any one time. And people don't think twice about this when they think about agriculture. Yeah, of course your plants grow out in the field somewhere. And you know, if you've ever driven through a farming area, it's like goes on forever. It's kind of amazing what we've managed to achieve. But then as soon as you say, well, you put a solar panel out, and for direct electricity conversion, it's like almost 10,000 times more energetically productive, about 100 times more economically productive than agriculture. And suddenly their brains explode because, like, even though humanity consumes about 100 times more energy in the form of oil and gas and electricity than in the form of food, it just doesn't compute that, like we're talking about like consuming large volumes of land here to produce large volumes of energy, but it's like 10,000 times more productive than agriculture. Anyway, but you know, people understand this eventually. Maybe they won't. I mean, people mostly don't think about energy, do they? Like, if you drive a gasoline powered car, you fill it up and it costs you $100 to fill up the tank, and you're like, wow, that's a lot. That cost a lot. But the amount of energy you just put in the tank is enough to feed your entire family for a year, right? If you could directly metabolize gasoline, like one tank full of gas would feed your family for, well, depending how big your family is, for like months and months at least. And if you fly to Australia, your per capita consumption of gasoline is on the order of like a ton of fuel, which would feed your entire family for like their entire lives. And we think, oh, well, it's an expensive airfare. Well, imagine if you had to feed the plane with food. Imagine if you had to feed your car. Like, have you ever tried like commuting by elephant? Like if you had to feed your, like make your elephant run down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, like it's going to get really hungry. It's just kind of crazy.
This is something I've been wanting to ask you since Duncan brought up Vaslav's mill earlier, because I thought the same thing. Is like, can you just tell us how you think about energy return on energy invested as a concept? Because it's something you see thrown around in nuclear, circles, obviously. But you're kind of making the inherent point, which we also talked about with Quincy, is that like, we live in an economy and it's really about capital more than it is about energy, right? But I do see how over time we have like increased energy return on energy invested, but solar sort of breaks that in some strange way because it's so cheap. So like, how do you think about that as a concept? Like, well, does it even matter? Like, is it even something we should even talk about? Like, obviously Smell talks a lot about it, but.
Yeah, he does. I don't know Smil personally.
Or writes about, rather. I don't know what he talks about.
I think it's one of those things, and I do quite a lot of pontification and writing on the space area, and like and there's kind of various rules of thumb that people use to try and, you know, navigate their way around an area that's not particularly intuitive. And one of them is energy return on energy invested. Right? It can help you think about comparing different forms of energy. Similarly, like when you're talking about space stuff, you might worry about like the specific impulse of your rocket engine or your fuel or the delta V required to get from the moon to Mars or something like that. And that would help you like understand some architectural constraints. But at the end of the day, you actually just have to do the math, right? And the math is like, it's not energy return on energy invested, it's dollars return on dollars invested. And like, that's what matters. Yeah, exactly. It's at the end of the day, our economy is based on energy, but it's not denominated in energy. It's denominated in dollars, which are a little bit of a blunt instrument, but also in their own way, a brilliant instrument. They're fungible. Like, there's just something beautiful about the fact that you know, a dollar can buy any number of things and it can be sold for any number. You can sell any number of things for a dollar. Like, yeah, it's the evil and the beauty of capitalism wrapped into one. And so that's what really matters. And I think for a long time solar got dinged because its energy return on energy invested was quite not very high. But that's certainly not the case anymore. And so it's, you know, I think like, you know, solar cells today charitably, conservatively, I should say, basically make their energy back in 3 years or so, and then they operate for 30 years. So like 10-to-1 gearing there is pretty good. It's better than oil and gas, that's for sure. It's certainly better than agriculture, modern agriculture, like industrial agriculture. because you know we burn an awful lot of oil to make our food, basically. Like if we were trying to run an agriculture system on biofuels, we would be going backwards extremely quickly. So I don't worry too much about that. Again, like I'm not bigoted against nuclear. I like nuclear power. I think humanity had the misfortune of discovering nuclear physics before we discovered immortality. And if we discovered how to do like cellular and DNA repair extremely efficiently, then nuclear would be no more hazardous than a tank of gas. Don't stick your hand in it, but it's okay. But like when I think like what is nuclear for? Like this incredibly energy dense source of stuff. It's for interplanetary travel, right? It's for building rockets that can take us to Pluto and back in a lifetime, as opposed to like 400 years. And we're not there yet, but if we live long enough, we'll see that deployed at scale. The idea of taking nuclear power and using it to make nuclear energy and make power is, it's almost antediluvian. It's almost Stone Age. It's like, we figured out how to turn steam into energy using steam engines, thanks James Watt. So we need a source of steam. Well, what are we going to use this incredibly esoteric and brilliant form of energy for? Boiling water.
Congratulations. I'm going to love to make that point.
You've made some steam at 300 Celsius. Wow, that's super high grade steam. my Instant Pot can do that. It just seems like a waste. And that's the reason that solar is so brilliant. Thermodynamically speaking, it's the exchanges between energy on the surface of the sun, which is at 5,800 Kelvin, and that essentially the efficiency of your thermal engine is determined by the difference in temperature between your hot side and your cold side. And if you could run your nuclear reactor at 5,800 Celsius, well, that would be a different matter. It's very hard to beat solar. There's no moving parts, and it's a two-dimensional layer of common materials. It's brilliant.
Out manufacture nuclear against that in a sense, but
Well, the problem with nuclear, and I know some people who have started nuclear companies, and I like them and I wish them well, and if I can help them in any way, I certainly do. But the fundamental problem with nuclear is it has to stop getting more expensive, and then it has to start getting cheaper. At the same time, it's currently like a long, long way behind solar, that is getting cheaper faster than any other form of energy has ever gotten, has ever done before. So it's not impossible, of course. It's not forbidden by the laws of physics, but it's quite hard to imagine how, for example, you could possibly build a nuclear reactor that could achieve a 3-year energy return on energy invested, or even dollar return on dollar invested, at $10 a megawatt hour. Like, how would you make that? It would have to be some form of bead of voltaics, right? It would have to have no moving parts. It would have to be composed of very, very thin sheets of silicon. And given that you're doing that, you may as well just put it out in the sun and do it the old-fashioned way without having to worry about the NRC. Kind of the same problem applies to fusion, but I guess there is a hope that we could do direct energy conversion cycles with either fission or fusion, to directly convert energetic charged particles into electricity, and that's really I think the only hope to get anywhere near solar. You have to delete the steam cycle.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not working on that though. That seems like a really hard problem. Merely making electrolysis 50 times cheaper than the competition is much more straightforward.
It's funny, like what you're doing, exactly. This is more like an aesthetic thing, but what you're doing, I think one could argue, is actually still sort of like praying at the church of energy density. You're just like looking at it in the other direction, right? All of your work is basically taking something diffuse and intensifying it, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas nuclear is kind of the opposite. It's taking something incredibly dense and sort of unintensifying it, whatever the right term for that is.
Making it more diffuse.
Making it more diffuse. Yeah, good. That's right. Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah. Well,
that's essentially what the sun has done for us. So, 173,000 terawatts of solar energy land on the Earth, but the Earth is pretty hard to see from the sun. We need to build the Dyson sphere and get all of it. I think I might leave that challenge for the grandchildren.
cool. James, you got anything else? My brain's in the cosmos right now.
Yeah. I would just say that I think that's where we landed with Sam D'Amico, who's like the other smartest person I know besides you. Nuclear's for space. That's cool. It's like nuclear's great. It's just we're gonna use it in space and not really as much on Earth as a lot of people think right now. So But no, yeah, I mean,
and nuclear
I,
submarines. Yeah. It's for submarines as well. Like, right. Let's be clear. But like, you and
yeah,
I.
Yeah, where's density valuable in right. mobility, basically? Yes.
Well, it's not yeah. even it's not even density for the nuclear submarines, because like the Australians have built gasoline powered submarines that are, 10,000 mile range. It's useful for stealth, put it that way, and for staying underwater for months at a time. That's quite hard to do with propulsion that depends on air. But yeah, nuclear is like nuclear wants to shine, right? Like you think like, how happy is a uranium atom? Does a uranium atom feel joy when it just like fizzes slightly and fissions slightly and then boils some water? No.
And then like runs joy. Your AC.
Yeah, uranium feels joy when it becomes an artificial sun. And of course that has negative externalities for the people who are nearby, to say the least. But like essentially that's its role in propulsion as well. It's like not merely heating water up to 300 Celsius. We want you to heat the water up to 15,000 Celsius and then propel us across the solar system at 1% of the speed of light, please.
Yeah, it's like a sports car, you know. It's like you don't just drive that around on the road. Like it wants
the sports car is unhappy.
You gotta let that thing rip.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
You don't drive that thing 30 miles an hour. It's an insult. Like get off the road.
as we near our end time here, I would love to hear more about that. I think this would just be fun. I read your water proposal.
How much time have you got?
And I don't know if James knows about this. Could you give us the high level on your water? Because it's like very similar sort of dynamics and concepts as we've talked about otherwise.
Well, so if nuclear is for propelling humans in just like inestimable glory across the solar system at high speed, then what is solar for? Well, solar is for improving our environment. Solar is for making lots and lots of very cheap energy. What is very, very cheap energy for? Well, you can do boring stuff like make synthetic fuel or powering houses, powering industry, metal refining, whatever. But it turns out that when solar gets cheap enough, you can actually do desalination of water, desalination of seawater. And then you're no longer waiting for like snow to melt or rain to fall. Although I do know a guy working on rainfall.
Is that Gondo boy?
Augustus Drucho. Yeah, he's a national treasure. Provide for your crops. So to make this concrete, historically the Colorado River has produced about 20 million acre feet of water per year, which is not a whole lot. It's not a huge river in the grand scheme of things. It's just a huge river by the standards of the American West. And about 5 million acre feet per year are taken up by California, mostly for agriculture. But actually the historical flow of the Colorado has been declining for a variety of reasons related to climate change and other factors, which means that there's kind of a shortage and the Colorado is not a healthy river. It does not reach the ocean in most years. And so the question is like, what would it take to build a large enough solar desal plant in like the Imperial Valley down by Yuma or Brawley or whatever, just north of the Mexican border or south of it. I don't really care. It takes water up out of the Gulf of California, desalinates it, and then processes the brine to remove metals and other high value commodities like lithium, because lithium, everyone needs more lithium now. And then redilutes the brine into the ocean and returns it. And at the same time, you can also run a spur line down to the Salton Sea and like fix that festering pustule on the face of California's environmental record. Stabilize its salinity and water level, and then build cities around it that are beautiful and shining paragons of what humanity can achieve in this century. And it turns out that this whole project altogether would cost, on the order of $40 or $50 billion over 10 years. If you did it the dumbest, most stupid, most obvious way, which is my preferred method. And it would, in terms of water revenue, it would just about pay for itself. And in terms of revenue from land value appreciation, obviously astronomical revenue, and in terms of revenue from metal extraction and other kind of ancillary high energy density chemical processing and metals processing and other manufacturing, it would be an enormous money spinner, an enormous source of prosperity. And actually Imperial County, which is this part of the world, is one of the poorest parts of California. It's really a kind of neglected area that's east of San Diego. And so I was like, well, what would this look like? And I basically wrote a blog post explaining how all this would fit together and how it'd work and how we could build it. And, basically no new technologies required. Basically just the will to basically pass an act of Congress, possibly to formalize aspects of the water transfer between Mexico and California. Although Arizona is actually in the process of doing something similar to this on their own with, with, um, with Mexico, and then we would produce 5 million acre feet of fresh water using solar power and the ocean indefinitely, regardless of the Colorado's flow. We could either double our water consumption, or we could release the Colorado's flow and let other people use it, restore the environment, restore the Colorado Delta, massively increase agricultural potential in Mexico, which had the misfortune of riding the water rights after they'd lost the Mexican-American War, and kind of got the raw end of the deal there. And I think that this is something that California should absolutely do. There's no reason why we shouldn't do it. We could easily afford it, and it would be a great way to basically fix some of the excesses, the environmental excesses that have taken place, and continue to impact the people who live in this part of the world who have all kinds of respiratory problems as a result of air pollution, as a result of the salt and sea, basically not working very well.
How much solar is this?
About 20 gigawatts. So like even on the scale of, well, that sounds like a lot, but like globally we deployed 460 gigawatts last year. So it's like, it's not even 5% of global solar production last year. And this year will be probably 50% more than that again.
Sounds like a good anchor customer for a giant solar module manufacturing site somewhere in the Southeast
Southwest. Southwest. You would also deploy, you wouldn't deploy it all in 1 year. Right? Well, that'd be impressive. That'd be like Knudsen level, deployment, like Hoover Dam level industrialization. We only did that in the 1930s. We don't have to do that anymore. It's too hard. But maybe you deployed over 10 years, basically, like that would allow you to take advantage of continuing reductions in cost of the fundamental products over time. And it'd be so sick. Like, that'd be so amazing. Can you imagine how cool that would be? Like, we can, it's basically like a step in the direction of saying, actually, as humans, cultivating our environment, cultivating our broader environment and maximizing the ecological productivity of land that we interact with is our responsibility. And we should absolutely do that, as opposed to being like, a river flows here, we're taking all the water, sucks to be anything else. Which was,
it sounds like you're saying, sounds like you're saying we need to terraform Earth.
Well, we already have.
You're unterraforming.
I want to be super clear.
You're saying unterraform it.
So the North American continent, there's a fabulous book by Charles Mann about this. The North American continent, when it was first encountered by European explorers in the 1400s, appeared cultivated and gardened. And that's because it was. Like in Australia, the indigenous Americans, they planted row crops of corn and stuff, but in places where they didn't do that, they still cultivated and gardened and pruned and so on the landscape. They used fire, stick farming, and a few other methods. And then, of course, the ravages of smallpox and kind of systematic extermination, amongst other things, basically allowed large swaths of the American landscape to become significantly wilder in the intervening 100, 200, 300, 400 years before kind of the Western expansion occurred. But the same story occurred in Australia, and you can read the original accounts of the explorers and see, like, they said to themselves, like, we spent a day and a half walking through taro fields, for example. And so when we think of like, oh, well, it would be nice if North America was as beautiful as it was in 1490 before smallpox. What that is an environment with humans on the land playing a custodial role where they're actively pruning and maintaining that landscape to maximize the ecological productivity of that landscape, ultimately so they can feed themselves, but also, in service of some sort of aesthetic sense. And I actually think that, with as lightest touch as possible, humans absolutely should continue to do that.
Yeah.
And it's also important to remember that, like, the Southwest of the United States is a desert, but it wasn't always a desert. In fact, 10,000 years ago, it was about as lush as Switzerland. It's just a very, very recent climate change as a result of the kind of the end of the last ice age that has resulted in all the lakes that were in what is now Death Valley and Nevada drying up, all the trees that were there dying, most of the species that were there moving away. And I'm not saying we should like, uniformly pave every last valley with solar power and then terraform the shit out of it. Although we pretty much already did that in like the Los Angeles Basin, for example, which looked nothing like it does now, 200 years ago. It was mostly then a swamp. And actually Florida has also been largely terraformed. But I think we could certainly afford to put much more water on the landscape and not necessarily to farm it, but just to, give some of the species that were there before a chance and restore wolves and bears and stuff. And I think it would be pretty awesome. We should remind ourselves that we can do great things as a species, and not just kind of, it's not a zero sum interaction with the environment. It's much more kind of give and take over a long period of time, but it requires vision, right? It requires I think the Imperial Valley should be the most beautiful part of California. I think it should be the place where everyone who currently like retires to Sonoma says, like, why would I go there? I should move to Imperial County, where like we've built a shining city that has you know, an average GDP of $250,000 per person, and airport that serves supersonic aircraft. You know, that like that'd be so cool. Anyway, maybe after Terraform we'll go and do that.
I feel like Duncan, I don't know if you had anything else, but I feel like that's a nice sentiment to end on, which is there's a form of EACC or like techno-optimism that's like, we're going to like sort of steamroll the environment. We're going to like build humans everywhere. Like we're just going to like dominate the environment and not.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Gaty Prime in Dune 2. Yeah. Maybe not.
Yeah. Right. Right. Like just stewardship in instead, you know,
stewardship. Exactly.
Flourish. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And the world is big enough that multiple different visions for how the environment could be restored can coexist.
Yeah.
But all of these are impossible unless we put more water on the landscape, and that's impossible unless we, for starters, solve the Salton Sea. I don't know if you spent much time down there, but it's a real shame. It could be like Geneva, right? It could be like Lake Geneva, but it's not. It's just a festering hellhole.
Well, I feel like we got the name of the episode, which is "Pave the Earth with Solar." That seems to be like let's see, 5%. That seems to be your headline. That's your headline.
Well, so actually, here's the crazy thing. Maybe this is a little late in the show to bring this up, but like right now, we use more land for biofuel in the United States than you would need to produce all our oil and gas synthetically. So you turn a bit of desert in Nevada into synthetic.
Like corn, you're talking about like corn fuel, ethanol and stuff.
Corn and soy, yeah. And all that corn and soy can go back to being prairie or forest. Right.
Wow.
And like, is that a trade you would take? I'd take that trade in a heartbeat. Why? Because, well, actually, the desert's actually like when you put solar panels on deserts, it shades the ground and improves moisture retention. Like one of the major problems we're facing with solar panels here in the West is that you put them all up in racks and 5 years later you've got trees growing and you're like, I didn't realize there were trees here. Like there shouldn't be trees here. Why are there trees growing between my solar panels? They're shading them. Right. But we're actually terraforming the land by putting solar panels on them. We're improving the ecological productivity and the carrying capacity of that land by shading it. And then the same thing goes for like, you know, maybe we can finally unyoke some of this land in the Midwest that we've been just blasting with fertilizers and pesticides and growing nothing but corn and soy for, you know, state after state after state. You know, do you think the pre-existing animals and plants like that very much? I doubt it. It would be pretty neat if we could, you know, focus our agricultural efforts on stuff that humans really need for their well-being and release the land that is otherwise just being used for biofuels in favor of synthetic fuels, which are much more basically a higher grade fuel product and much lower land use.
Yeah, biofuels seem to be the sort of like most overlooked sort of perversion in the energy system.
They're crazy. So crazy.
I don't think we have time to get started on that. I concur that they're sub-ideal. Yeah, in the absence of alternatives, sure. But like that solar is cheap enough. We can do better than that.
Yeah.
So you're saying today we could just swap out all biofuel production for solar synthetic fuel production and use the same or less amount of land?
50-1.
50-1. This seems like
land use reduction for the same fuel.
So like obvious when, like this isn't like in 30 years close. When solar is dirt cheap. It's just like today, easy, done.
Okay. Easy, done. Yeah.
Cool. Let's do it.
And like the farmers would like it too, because like you make way more money with solar than with like corn. You get like a couple of $100 per acre. With solar, you get a couple of $100 per day per acre. So it's just a better deal.
Amazing. Cool.
All right.
Well, Casey, definitely. This has been super fun. Thank you so much. Very enjoyed this very, I'd say it's a little headier than our typical
long
episode.
Sesh.
Yeah. But super fun. Super fun. Thank you.
Come back and we'll talk about Mars industrialization.
I love it.
That really gets into the weeds. Okay.
All righty.
Thanks, Casey. See you, man.
See ya.
Bye.